Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for May 5th, 2013. I guess some people might say happy Cinco de Mayo, but we're talking politics either way. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And welcome back to the show, Catherine Smith.
Hello, is it May or is it October? Or is it Maytober?
I know what you
sure
mean by the
like
weather.
Sure feels like October to me.
Yeah, it got cold. It was real funny. I was out there cutting grass, and I blew, and I think because of all the moisture in the air, it, you know, condensation appeared, you know, like it's cold. I was like, what is up with this? But it's just a weird weather storm. Tim and I are, you know, I guess everybody's wet, but we've got a lot of rivers in our area, and so we're having to worry about flooding in different places.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and I guess it's going to keep on like this. Well, I guess we're going to have a lot of topics, and halfway through the show, we're going to have Brock McCleary from Harper Poland come back in to join us. He's going to tell us about some of the polling he's been doing. Also, it's from a Republican perspective, which is good to have. So we're going to talk to Brock about halfway in, and we're going to talk about topics until then. And the first topic I want to bring up is not overtly political, but probably as sad as anything we've talked about on the Kudzu Vine. Early last week, I guess it was Monday or Tuesday, I sent y'all this story. In Kentucky, a 5-year-old boy shot and killed his 2-year-old sister. Now, I don't have any thought that the little boy thought that this would happen. He was essentially playing with a gun called a Cricket, but I guess it's essentially like a .22 caliber rifle that he got for his birthday. I mean, I guess, and you know, when your 5-year-old gets things, they think it's a toy. Even if you sit them down and say, oh, this is serious stuff, but if they have access to it, you can only imagine that a 5-year-old thinks it's a toy. He shoots and kills his sister. The fact that this gun is marketed to children, called a Cricket, this whole company apparently sells pink and red and blue guns, and it's all marketed towards kids, and probably not even kids like 13 or 14. We're talking kids like 5. This is just, to me, a sad state of affairs. And I told y'all, I think, when I first read this, to me, this is more of a case for gun control than the Newtown incident. Because I think you can argue, hey, somebody that's, you know, an adult that's crazy enough could find some access, some way to do something horrific. But you can't tell me if there were some regulations on things like Cricket, pink and blue guns, that a 5-year-old would be able to get a gun and do this. Catherine, when you read the story, what was your reaction?
Well, I just thought it was, of course, my first reaction was that it was tragic for that poor boy. I mean, he's going to live with this for the rest of his life, that he killed his sister, and that's horrible. And for the parents, who I'm sure are just horrified and, you know, feel, you know, ultimately responsible, as they should. But then in reading more about it and discovering, you know, little do I know, I don't pay much attention to these things, that this company makes guns in all different colors and a couple different sizes specifically for children under 10. And it's, I want to just point out that the boy is 5 now, but he's had the gun for a year. So he got it when he was 4. So I just don't, I mean, I agree that, you know, there should be some way to control this. However, I also think that, you know, what parent gives their 4-year-old a gun?
And that goes
a functional gun.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to culture, most definitely. But you have to think that, you know, there's a culture where people, you know, smoke around their kids, but we hope they don't give their kids cigarettes. There's a culture where people drink around their kids, but we hope they don't, you know, pour them a drink. You know, that somehow you have to say, hey, this is a adult thing. You know, I mean, we just don't have these sitting around the house like a toy. Because think how many kids get toy guns. And, I mean, toy guns, you know, they make a sound. They're for pretend. So I think for a 4 or 5-year-old, it's very hard to that line's very blurred between what's a toy and what's real. And it's something
that you can't expect
a kid to know.
A 4-year-old gets something for their birthday. It's a toy. I mean,
yeah.
As far as they're concerned, I mean, what else do you give a 4-year-old but toys?
You
can't explain to a kid that's 4 or 5 years old that, you know, this is a gun that's used for hunting and we only use it for this purpose. Oh, but by the way, we're just going to leave it propped up on the wall over here with ammunition in it. And, I mean, it just seems to be awfully it makes me feel like people just don't take guns very seriously in whatever culture that is.
Yeah. I mean, Tim, your thoughts on this?
Well, sadly, this sort of thing, while not very common, fortunately, is also not unheard of. These sort of things seem to happen in a culture permeated with firearms. But you know, it is senseless. Let's think of it this way. You can't legally drive until you're 15 or 16. Nobody would let a 5-year-old on the highway to drive. You can't vote until you're 18. No 5-year-old can go in the voting booth and vote, even though some people vote like they're 5. But that's another story. You can't drink in most places until you're 21 years old. A 5-year-old going in a bar, that would be a sight. But you can get a gun as a Christmas present when you're 4? I mean, that's ridiculous. This company does it for one reason. They carved out a niche to make profit. They don't care about anything else. So that's what they're about. You know who could help in this, guys? And don't fall out of your chairs when I say this, but the NRA. Now, they were founded as a gun safety group. And I'm not foolish enough to believe that all the guns are going away. They're not going to go away. This country loves guns. I don't know why, but they do. And they're always going to be here, some of them. So the thing to do, and the government should actually work with the NRA on this, promote a nationwide thing, a gun safety course, and every person at a certain age, I don't know, 15 years old, has to take that gun safety course before they can legally own a gun. Now, what would be wrong with that?
If to own a gun, I thought you were going down the road, you had to take it, and I would say, well, that'd be like saying you'd have to take a course to safely drink, and you have no interest in drinking. You have to take a course to safely smoke in bed, and you're never going to smoke. You're telling people to take a course on something they never plan to do. But I get what you're saying. Own a gun. You're talking about a license.
Yeah, if we regulate everything else, why not this as well? Why is that not logical?
Yeah, a gun and a car are pretty analogous. I've heard in Florida that don't they make you take swimming lessons? They offer them, you know, free everywhere. I mean, they try to say, hey, you can easily drown. We want to teach you to swim so you don't. Here, a gun in this type of situation is lethal, no doubt. You know, have safety. Yeah.
Well, you know what it'd do? If they did what I suggested, then a killing like this terrible tragedy would not be something that would be in the news anymore, right?
We would hope. I mean, it would be less common.
Well, because you've got a whole, you know, generations of people who didn't take that.
Right.
But, I mean, that's, you know, it all takes time. But I think that's an excellent idea, just like driving, like David said. I think it's, you know, it makes sense. It's a, you know, proactive way to handle a situation. But it'll never happen.
That's true. It probably never will. When we're dealing with people, especially at the federal level, that can't even agree on what day of the week it is, you know.
Plus, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who would say, and, you know, I'm a parent. I can teach my child what they need to know. No government or organization needs to come into my house and tell me how to do something.
And I'm sure these people that bought this gun for this kid said the same thing, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but here's the thing. People could say, hey, I can teach my child to drive. And, you know, we know that driving safety is a good idea. You even have to have insurance to do it. Maybe that'd be another step. You could have insurance on a gun.
Yeah, why don't we have gun insurance?
That'd be pretty grim. It might be able to think twice about it. Of course, it might also lead to more illegal gun ownership because people would not want to register to try to avoid paying the insurance.
Well, yeah, well David, one more point. That Catherine was right. A kid's 5 years old. He had no idea what he was even doing with that gun. And that's back to my point. There is something, and it's biblical. It's called the age of accountability. And that's what we should step toward with guns in this country. Five-year-olds shouldn't be running around the house with loaded guns.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and loaded guns should not be propped up against the wall, and nobody knew that there was ammunition in it. I mean, I mean, that's like, with a five-year-old and a two-year-old in the house, it's one thing if it's all adults in the house. Still not a good idea, but at least, you know, but when you've got a five-year-old and a two-year-old in the house and you have a gun, a loaded gun, just like sitting in the, and I think that's what they said, it was just sitting in the corner.
it's
sad.
Awful.
I just feel so sorry for that little boy. I mean, he's just going to have to live with this whole life.
Yep.
Yeah, well, let's kind of change gears into something in some ways more, I mean, obviously, lighter and in some ways more comical, or in some ways comical, obviously much more comical than this, whatever. It's not at all funny. The South Carolina won special election. Terrible segue, by the way, I admit it. South Carolina won special election. Let's start off, I guess, the thing that, you know, came out right off, and that would be that Larry Flint endorsed Mark Sanford.
I love Larry Flint. I just got to say, I love Larry Flint.
But I will say this. He was not Mark Sanford in no way is a pioneer because this kind of thing's been going on quite a while. So there's nothing pioneering about what he did. Maybe he's never had the South Carolina to Argentina angle. But he comes out and endorses him. I don't know what that does for his campaign. Additionally, Ashley Madison, which is apparently a, I won't say an online dating service, but apparently an online maybe cheating service. Would that be a better way to say it? They're using Mark Sanford's image, I guess against his will, to sell their service. I wonder if he could actually sue for money because, you know, like if you use somebody in a positive light to sell your product, they would have a right to say, hey, I want my money. It seems like Mark Sanford could,
it might,
you know,
be different if you're a public figure.
I'm wondering, Michael Jordan's a public figure. Could Adidas start slapping pictures of Michael Jordan up next to Adidas sneakers?
Probably not.
He's a public figure. I'm thinking if Mark Sanford wanted some money, he could say, I want my cash. Tim, go ahead with your button.
But in these extraordinary circumstances, I think he circled a date on the calendar to pursue this legally if he decided to, and that's the day after the election. Because he certainly don't want to file a suit before this election and remind people all over again what he's trying to make them forget. So, you know, it's funny, though, ain't it? It is. What's really funny is he might win.
Well, you know,
when I was
ready for the show tonight, I was looking around. I did a Google News search on the South Carolina one, and I didn't notice what link I was pressing, so I ended up at the Washington Times, which is a, you know, ultra-conservative, you know, newspaper, I say loosely. And I started reading it, and it was like, well, as for conservatives, the only choice is Mark Sanford. And I thought, you know, isn't that funny? Like, this guy is like, you know, I mean, when I think of conservatives in this era, I think, you know, of them all touting family values and law-abiding and, you know, upstanding citizens. And then you look at Mark Sanford, and he's like, cheated on his wife, lied about it, lied to his the citizens of South Carolina about it, and then, most recently, illegally entered his ex-wife's home. So what is conservative about that?
Yeah.
The fact that he has an R beside his name.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
exactly all that matters. You know, and Tim, you mentioned this poll. Kind of give us the details, because I think you spent more time looking at it than the two of us have. Tell us the details of
the tweet,
I guess you'd say.
What it is a teaser that Tom Jensen has released. You know, he likes to tweet these teasers about his upcoming polls, and they have had a last-minute poll out in the field in South Carolina. I think the results are going to be published late tonight or early in the morning, and according to him, they're going to show that Sanford is closing in.
Yeah.
We have a toss-up.
And I tell you what, I'm really not surprised. You know, I love to talk, unfortunately, I love to talk about the David Bitter race and how we had a good candidate and couldn't come close to defeating David Bitter. Now we have Mark Sanford, who, of course, you know, abandoned his job, cheated on his wife, broke into our house, violated the divorce agreement. But, you know, there used to be an old saying in Louisiana, don't get caught with a live boy or a dead girl. I think there's a lot of parts in the South now. There's three things. Don't get caught with a live boy, dead girl, or a D beside your name. And I think the third one can be the most fatal. And so it's almost like no matter what we do in some places, we can't win just because people just see Democrat non-starter. And that's a sad state of affairs, because you're going to get some really, really suspect Republican candidates. And, I mean, Republicans could say to us in some of these ultra-Democratic districts, you end up with some really suspect Democratic candidates. I mean, that's probably, to be fair, the way you end up with a Bill Jefferson in Congress is because it was such a Democratic district. This is such a Republican district that we may end up with a Mark Sanford after all of his disastrous behavior.
What, though, David? If I lived in the state of South Carolina, I could not have brought myself to vote for Alvin Green in the Senate election. I would not have voted in that race. I could not do it. There's sometimes you've got to put your other things ahead of your party. Now, you've got to. If not, what kind of a person are you?
Well, and I'll tell you this. Alvin Green was comical. I mean, he was not.
But the man,
and I'm not saying for different
reasons,
he was not qualified in any means, but he was a joke. This is somebody
different
that's getting away.
You don't think Mark Sanford is a joke?
He's a different kind of joke.
He's still a joke. I say unfit to serve. Let's agree.
Yeah, I agree he's unfit to serve. But I'm just saying, but they're two different things. I mean, Alvin Green somehow was kind of had delusions of grandeur, put his name on the ballot, somehow got the nomination. Mark Sanford just has this, you know, I guess a smirk on his face saying, I can probably get away with this. You know, he's not dumb. He's more, I mean, not evil, maybe a strong word, but he's more, you know, there's something much more deceitful about what he's going to get away with.
But David, I just got through saying that I will not vote for anybody just because they have that D behind their name. Not in every case. How can a Republican look at me and say that they are more fair and open-minded than me if they absolutely will vote for the Republican, no matter who or what they are?
Well, because here's what they would come back at you, Tim. They'd say, yeah, but if I don't vote for Mark Sanford, I'll get that sorry old Democrat the brother of Stephen Colbert, the sister of Stephen Colbert. They see her as evil because she's a Democrat.
And if I lived in South Carolina, David, who would I despise more than Jim DeMint? Well, nobody. But I just got through saying that I would not have voted for his opponent, so I would come back at them with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're taking a very pure, I won't say ideological pure, I'm talking about a very, I guess, democracy-wise, pure
patriotic
stance. And that's admirable, but there's probably going to be 50% plus one voters, unfortunately, in South Carolina that won't think that way. Because I've got to the point, I told somebody last night that I thought this race was 50-50. That was before I got this information from Tom Jensen. And now after hearing this poll is moving in that direction, I'll go ahead and go on record that I think Mark Sanford's going to be the next congressman from South Carolina 1. And that's sad, but that's what I really think. Are y'all going to make predictions?
I think Colbert's going to win.
Colbert,
the last
poll
I saw, she was 9 points up. He's going to make up 9 points.
Well, we'll see this poll when it comes out in the morning, I guess. I wish Tom was listening to our show, or we could text him real quick or something, that we could get him a sneak look at the numbers. But I get the idea that this thing was closing and closing, and now it's going to close up, and it's just going to go against us. I hope I'm wrong, but that's just what I think. Tim?
You know what really worries me? Yeah, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to agree with you, David. And what made me finally do it, I noticed all of a sudden here come Governor Haley to campaign for him. Here's Lindsey Graham endorsing him. And you know, the big players like that, I don't think would even touch this race if they thought it was going to stain them in any way. I think they know something or sense something.
I see that as the, you know, them looking at a, you know, worrying about their you know, their numbers in Congress and thinking, well, we thought we weren't going to worry about it, but now it looks like she might win. So, you know, sort of jumping on a sinking ship.
Well, Catherine, I kind of agree with you on the worrying about numbers. And here's what I think they're really worried about. They're worried that some of those Tea Party, you know, zealot Republicans in South Carolina, what could use it against them that they didn't support Mark Sanford when he ran against that nasty old Democrat. You know, they're afraid of what people will think. I mean, my goodness, you let Mark lose, who cares what he did? You know, he was the Republican. You had to support
David,
him, and that's what they're really afraid of.
If this doesn't shake voters away from the Republicans in that district, then all I can say is that district's gone. Nothing will.
Mitt Romney win 17 points?
Yeah, something like that. But,
it's already gone.
Mitt Romney didn't go to, you know, Argentina to visit his girlfriend at the taxpayer's expense and do all of that stuff.
Into his ex-wife's house and...
Yeah.
This man is just not a good person. He does not deserve to be in Congress.
He doesn't.
You
and
know?
The Republican Party there really needs to think long and hard about who they're nominating. Because I can't imagine with 750,000 people in a district, they couldn't find a better person to serve their party.
And he's going to court 2 days after this election. What if he gets indicted?
We'll be doing this all over again. Although, honestly, it'll probably won't be Elizabeth Colbert, and then they'll, I would hope, get a better candidate than Mark Sanford. You'd have to work to find one worse. I mean, unless you start visiting prisons or mentally something.
That's where he may go.
Or maybe they could look on Ashley Madison to find their next candidate. But I guess
that's
the rich
dude. I love that.
The ladies. They have to be looking for the rich dudes, I guess. You get an
extra point for that one, David.
I guess that makes up for that transition. But let's continue to talk about some subjects until we get there at that midpoint when Brock comes on in. And I want to talk about the Miami Dolphins, the Sun Life Stadium, the stadium that's had about five names since it was originally called Joe Robbie Stadium, that they need upgrades. Now, I think that stadium it came into being, I guess, in the late 80s, so it's older than the Georgia Dome, we'll be fair that way. But they wanted the state of Florida to pay for upgrades. The state of Florida voted, or actually, I guess they didn't even bring it up to vote on, because it was supposed to, I guess, be brought to a referendum, but they wouldn't even get it to put on the ballot. And so I wonder what is so different in Florida than Georgia, where in Georgia they just, I mean, couldn't get that stadium built, the new stadium built through faster. Here they're just talking about upgrading a stadium. I guess you have to think that wouldn't cost near as much.
$350 million.
What's different about Georgia legislators and Florida legislators? Tim?
Well, there is something different going on in Miami. You know, they went through this rigmarole of building the new stadium for the Marlins.
Yeah.
That just opened, what, last year? And it went through the same thing, raising taxes for this and that and the other. And then as soon as the season's over last year, the owner of the Marlins goes to selling off all of his good ball players. The team is terrible, which leaves some rather surly voters in the Miami-Dade area. Well, just guess who they're talking about putting this hotel tax on to help pay for part of this? The voters in the Miami-Dade area and the legislature, as an act of self-preservation, is not going to come anywhere near even touching this. They didn't even allow it to the floor for a vote. And it's a privately owned stadium, Sun Life Stadium is. It's not a publicly owned stadium, and they're just not going to have any of it. That's what's going on.
And see, the way it worked was really smart, because all those legislators can say, oh, I would have voted for it if it had come to the – I was going to vote for it. I was going to vote for it. But, you know, conveniently, their leader never brought it to the floor. So he's taking all the blame, I guess, which he seems okay with, because he's a, like, real fiscal conservative, and he doesn't believe in this kind of stuff. But meanwhile, all the other guys can take cover. Very smart, actually.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, you're right, the political acumen may be very smart, but I'll tell you what I do respect about this. You know, Republicans want to talk about fiscal responsibility and, you know, no government spending and on and on and on. Well, in Georgia, they talk a lot about that, but they were really quickly to push this thing through without, you know, much input from the voters. But in Florida, they seem to be actually following their playbook. So I can actually respect that. And I'll say this. I don't know. It may be that the upgrades may have been needed there. I haven't even looked at the whole project, because I know, you know, Miami, they do a pretty good job getting Super Bowls and, you know, big events like that. Whereas I know that Marlins Stadium, the biggest problem the Marlins Stadium is nobody comes to watch the stinking Marlins. So why build a new stadium for a team that can't sell tickets? And they couldn't sell tickets, they're good or bad. But that's a whole other discussion. So I just had to respect that. Now, I did see on Pro Football Talk, the Dolphins may even move, which that's one thing that makes, I guess, Florida a more complicated state. And a state like California and Texas, same way. It has multiple large cities to serve, because, of course, if you give money to Miami, Tampa, and Jacksonville is going to say, where's my money?
Well, that's what I was wondering about.
You just have one big city to serve, if you will, for these kind of projects. Well, I want to go ahead and transition again to our guest for the evening, back again from Harper Polling, Mr. Brock McCleary. Welcome, Brock.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
Good to have you back on.
I'm
doing good.
Good.
Yeah. You've been quite busy. I believe you've done about 4 state polls since we last talked. And I know different ones of us will ask about different polls, but I want to go ahead and ask about Montana before I pass it along for Catherine and Tim to ask about Michigan and New Jersey and Louisiana and everywhere else. In Michigan, Max Baucus decided not to run, and it looks like from polling you've done, that's probably a blessing in disguise for the Democrats, because Brian Schweitzer seems to be a little bit more popular than Max Baucus.
Yeah, that is certainly the case. So we tested Senator Baucus's image with Montana voters. It was a he got a 43% favorable opinion and a 47% unfavorable. So he was clearly going to be in very difficult circumstances had he chosen the re-election. I don't think there's any question, however, that Brian Schweitzer gives them a much better chance to hold the seat. His, by comparison, image rating was 54% favorable and only 37% unfavorable. So clearly they're in a better position, but I will tell you, in looking at this poll, and it seems as though Montana, just the environment out there is very well suited for a Republican to win. We asked generically, would you rather be represented by a Republican or a Democrat in the Senate? And the Republican came out at 42 and the Democrat 34. So I think even Schweitzer is going to be sailing into the wind a little bit here.
Yes. Yeah, so now, Montana is a little bit different state. I mean, obviously in Idaho, the Dakotas, Wyoming, I mean, a Democrat even being the ball game is amazing. But Montana is not a swing state, but in a Western rural state is a swing state, if you will. Why is that?
You know, that's a good question. I think that I think there is something sort of independent-minded about the West. I think Montana seems to really, you know, there's a lot of sort of union roots there that are, you know, that go back generations. So I think culturally it's more of a Republican state, but they're certainly very familiar, obviously, with voting for Democrats.
Yes. Well, I'm going to interject here. Don't you think that's really, I mean, I think Brian Schweitzer, it's more about Brian Schweitzer than it is about Democrats, don't you? I mean, I think Brian Schweitzer is very well liked. He's been a very good governor. He's done a lot for, you know, economic development, and he's not, you know, ultra liberal or anything. So I think that it may be more about the personality of Brian Schweitzer than it is really about Democrats. I might be wrong about that, but that's my impression.
No, I think there's no doubt that's very true. As I told you, that, you know, they would rather have a Republican, but when you put Schweitzer up against the most well-known Republican, in this case it would be Mark Roscoe, who may or may not be running. I don't think he's made that clear, but there he starts out with a lead. So obviously it's a small one, it's 4%, but still, if they're losing by 8% sort of generically, and yet he can put them you know, plus 4 on an initial ballot, then obviously there's something that's unique about Brian Schweitzer here.
Yes, now if Mark Roscoe, he runs, that's two popular governors that serve back-to-back. That would be a very hard-fought race. Let's say Mark Roscoe doesn't make the race. Who's the best candidate for the Republicans?
Well, according to this survey, it would clearly be Steve Daines, the first-term congressman. He is, of course, it's an at-large seat, so he essentially represents the entire state. He has a pretty strong, you know, 41-26 favorable to unfavorable. Now against Schweitzer, he would start the race down 10, so it'd be Schweitzer at 50, Daines at 40. But you know, Daines has not. I don't think that's a terrible place for him to start from, having only run one statewide campaign. And as you point out, Schweitzer has, you know, pretty long history there. So Daines would appear to be the next strongest Republican.
Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and pass it over to Catherine and Ernest so she can ask about the next state. And Catherine, your home state's on the table if you want it.
Yeah, I do. So, you know, I'm from Michigan. So,
okay.
I read, you know, your sort of write-up about the Senate race in Michigan. And, you know, I think while when we talk about Brian Schweitzer, I think Jennifer Granholm is almost the opposite. She's like, I think, perceived as a very strong Democrat. And, you know, my friends love her, but I think she's, you know, generally one of the women Republicans hate. So how do you think that's going to and do we know which Republicans are going to run for sure? Has anybody declared?
Well, no, I mean, so Gary Peters has announced, and he is off and running. It's unclear, you know, whether Granholm would make a run here. Peters has long been considered kind of the next guy in line by Democratic politicos in Michigan. as I'm told, Gary Peters is a pretty savvy politician. So, you know, and Granholm, I think, would start out with a little bit of a, you know, she for better or worse, has a kind of a mixed, I'd say there's mixed opinion in Michigan about her. 43% would say she has a favorable opinion. 47% say unfavorable. You know, whereas the advantage, however, is that she's universally known, and so she does, you know, she does start leading. She would lead most Republican challengers, although, you know, not by a tremendous amount, but she would have lead, you know, Justin Amash, say, by 43-34. Mike Rogers would be 42-40. Now, against Gary Peters, Peters would not, you know, Peters just doesn't have the name identification. So you see the head-to-head matchup between, let's say, Mike Rogers, who I think is a pretty potential candidate, and Peters, you know, was 23-20. So what that tells you is really neither of them, whether it's Gary Peters as a Democrat, whether it's Mike Rogers, whether it's Justin Amash, doesn't appear to be someone who would start out with a lot of statewide name identification. So I think that's going to be a very very interesting race. What Republicans actually run, you know, I don't think that any of the top guys have pulled the trigger yet, but I understand that both Amash and Rogers are giving it a pretty close look.
Yeah, the other advantage I think Jennifer Granholm will have is that she can raise money all over the country. You know, she can fly in any major city and rile up some progressives to help fund her, because people like, you know, nope. she's a good speaker and all that. She's well, I'm going to turn this over to Tim, and then maybe David will come back around to me if we need to.
Well, good evening, Brock, and thank you for being back on with us again.
Yes, sir.
I know that polling up in New Jersey has just universally, of course, shown that Governor Christie is on his way to a blowout victory. He pulls in, you know, of course, his fair share of Democratic admirers in New Jersey, and he is winning overwhelmingly among Republicans and independents. And I know that you have seen the conservative blogosphere not be, shall we say, charitable to Governor Christie because of, you know, the stuff with meeting with the president the week before the election and all that. But yet, New Jersey Republicans view this very differently. Is it because they literally bore the eye of the storm and saw firsthand how well Governor Christie reacted to this emergency? Or what is the driving force that makes New Jersey Republicans view this race differently than Republicans at large?
Well, I would say from a Hurricane Sandy perspective, certainly I think they had an up close. I used to live in New Jersey one time, very familiar with the shore area. You know, it's a small state. It's a lot of people in a small state. I think that they saw firsthand the way that Governor Christie, you know, led them through that difficult time. And I, you know, I think that his popularity, frankly, I think only gets stronger. I think he's now put himself in a position which is, I think, very difficult for a lot of politicians to get to. But the more the people try to beat him up, the more the voters of his state love him. We had run a survey there right after the Conservative Political Action Conference had declined to invite him to speak, which, you know, was, you could speculate as to why that might be. But when we asked them whether that made them more or less likely to like Governor Christie, he came out very much ahead of that. They were 49%
wow,
more likely to support him because he had been declined an invitation to attend what is fairly described as the largest annual meeting of conservative Republicans around the country. So, you know, it only gets stronger for him, and sadly it does appear as though it's going to be a boring race, and that's unfortunate because I think everyone would enjoy watching Governor Christie if he was in a dogfight. But at this point, it looks like it's smooth sailing.
And that was actually, you just jumped right into my next question. I know that no one likes to say it's over until it is. But essentially, if somebody put a gun to your head and said, okay, declare one race in this country over in this election cycle, is that the race?
Well, based on the polling data, and there is no lack of polling in New Jersey.
Right.
A lot of pollsters love to poll there. It's pretty unanimous that, you know, listen, there are unforeseen circumstances, surely. But on its current trajectory, these two candidates, I think this is probably the safest bet. And how unusual. As someone who had worked in New Jersey Republican politics for some time, it's very unusual to have a Republican statewide that essentially is headed into reelection with a snoozer of a race. It's just virtually unheard of. I mean, we might wait decades or generations before we see another guy like Chris Christie as a Republican be so beloved in that state.
Yeah, I second that motion. And I'm going to leave this great state of Louisiana, which I'm sure David is chomping at the bit to get on, David.
Yes, well, Louisiana, we finally get into a southern state on the kudzu bomb, which is our wheelhouse. And it seems in the last, you know, 6-8 years, unless Landrieu was on the ballot, Democrats really don't have much of a shot statewide in Louisiana. But, of course, Landrieu's on the ballot. So your polling showed that Mary Landrieu's up, but it's not the lead Chris Christie has, let's say. But you tested Bill Cassidy. You may have tested other Republicans. What did you find there?
Well, you know, we found Mary Landrieu in, you know, considering that it is, I think Louisiana is fairly described as a Republican state at this point. You know, her image rating was not bad, 48 to 42, I mean, 48 favorable, 42 unfavorable. You know, she, however, against Bill Cassidy, now, you know, Bill's a pretty accomplished Republican congressman, but not terribly well known throughout the state. You know, and so, however, despite not having a lot of name identification, you know, he started out in pretty good shape. Landrieu was at 46 against Cassidy, and he was at 41, so 46-41. Now, that you would suspect will only get better for Bill Cassidy because his 41 slowly increases naturally as people get to know him more. And what really struck me as I was doing some research in preparation for that survey is, you know, Mary Landrieu only got 52% of the vote in 2008, which was obviously a very good, you know, year for Democrats. And so it just this survey, my takeaway was it really feels like this is the time that Republicans finally get that seat back. I think she's clearly the best, as you point out, probably the best Democrat they could hope to have running. But it may just be too much this time around.
Well, I think both parties would agree this thing's going to go long. It's going to be one you have to watch. And I guess if Louisiana law stays the same like it was in, I guess, 2002 when she won it in the special election, it was one of the few, I guess, bright spots after the 2002 election where she won it after the fact that it could go much like that one. We've got some more questions we want to ask you about maybe other big races around the country. But one I want to ask you generally is there still continues to be stories about, you know, the Republicans, the direction of the future, and what they need to do to kind of, you know, reform themselves as a party. And I kind of thought back to a sermon I had heard recently, what a preacher said, you know, one thing that a lot of people that aren't Christians see Christians are when they ask to describe them in a word, and they came up with the word judgmental. And I thought, well, that also seems like the way people that aren't Republicans view a lot of Republicans, that a lot of the things they get hurt on are being judgmental, you know, particularly, I guess, with, like, their views towards gays or, in some case, minorities or illegals, at least illegal citizens, what have you. Do you see that that's a problem for the Republicans, is that they're seen as too judgmental of people that aren't like them?
Well, I don't know that if it's an issue of judgmental. I think it's an issue of listening. We had participated in some focus groups actually last election cycle where we looked at some independent voters and persuadable women voters and tried to get a little bit of a sense as to what their hesitation was with Republicans. And it wasn't so much their position on issues. I think it was an issue, was a matter of tone. And I think kind of an issue to a perception of certitude about their position that I think is in some cases admirable. But when you're trying to attract more women voters, Hispanic voters, middle-of-the-road voters, I think a little more of a perception of listening to all points of view, being understanding and respectful of different points of view without really, because I don't think that the positions fundamentally are the problem. It's really I think it's the tone.
Yes. Okay. Well, I just had seen that, and it just seems to be that there's something there. And I think the way you brought the skill of listening in, or at least the perception of it, and as we know in politics, perception is reality, that kind of spoke to that. Well, I'm going to pass it around again for races, kind of races maybe you hadn't polled on, but because somebody in your polling world, you've seen other results, and you might can give a different perspective on. Catherine, I'll start with you. Just any other races around the country that you want to ask Brock about, and it can be ones we've already talked about.
Well, I think we all are interested in what's happening in South Carolina in the first district. We talked about that earlier. Apparently, there's some new polling that may be out tomorrow that shows that Mark Sanford is closing in that lead that Colbert had. What, do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, it does appear as though and talking to some folks who are on the ground and are seeing what's happening there up close and personal, it does appear as though to them, now this is purely anecdotal, but that the momentum has shifted a little bit, and I would be lying to you if I told you I understood why that may be. I think Mark Sanford's hanging in, running a gritty campaign, but, he's had a number of challenges expected and some unexpected. PPP, the Democratic IVR polling firm, had polled over the weekend, and I saw yesterday they tweeted that the race had tightened considerably. So 2 weeks ago they had Colbert Bush up 8 at 50-42. And we'll know tomorrow when they release their results, but they seem to indicate that the race has tightened. And, they had a debate. The reviews of the debate were seemed to indicate that she got the better of the exchange. However, if momentum if he has recaptured momentum, sometimes things happen in politics that are beyond explanation, and
yes.
There may be something that's happening on the ground that's hard to see. You may not be able to find it in a poll. You may just get it by listening to people on the street, but it may appear as though things are swimming back his direction. Is there enough time? We'll see.
Okay. Tim, I'm passing it to you.
Yes, sir. I want to jump up to the great state of Virginia here with its governor's race. The election is 6 months away, I know, yet two recent surveys that I've seen, one showed Puccinelli 8 points up, and the other new one out showed him 10 points up in the Washington Post. And it just looks like this race is already getting away from Terry McAuliffe. So I have two questions here. The first question is that your take on the race as well, that this thing may be getting away from Terry McAuliffe? And the second question is, why does it always seem that voters in Virginia elect a governor from the party opposite of the party in the White House? Or is that just my imagination?
Well, I don't know, but as you say that, appear to be some. It does sound as though that has been the case often. There are places that like to have place bets on all sides of the table if they can. It's probably too early to say that the race would be getting away from McAuliffe. However, he is. He's enduring some difficult issues, he wrote the book. If you can go and see excerpts of it everywhere, and That book was not written by a man who ever thought he was going to run for office, I can tell you that. But he probably should have had the forethought to think he might one day want to run for something. But I will say this, you would rather have this stuff happen now, have it wear on you, have its impact, and then hope that it becomes old news by the time, you know, the election season is off and running. But clearly that book will produce a heck of a lot of TV ads that will ultimately be run against McAuliffe.
So you're not ready to call this race by any stretch of the imagination?
No, I would not think so. These things have, lots of ebbs and flows. However, there's no question that Terry McAuliffe is not your average candidate, and so the ebbs and flows here are often very high and very low for a guy as colorful and a guy who has such a long history in politics as Terry McAuliffe does. Cuccinelli appears to be, the race. Often in a campaign, you want to try to make the race about the other guy. Your objective is often to make it a referendum on him and not so much a choice between the two of you. I think Cuccinelli has the potential here to run that kind of race, to make it all about McAuliffe because of who he is, because of all the things that have followed him throughout his political career. He could probably make the race a referendum on McAuliffe, and I would think that's probably enough to take care of him. But believe me, Terry McAuliffe will raise many, many millions of dollars to try to tell a story about Ken Cuccinelli just as well.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to jump up to one more state, and then I'll turn it back over to David. Some pollsters up in Massachusetts have shown the special election Senate race up there to be, in the low to mid single-digit leads for Markey. Could we see a repeat of a 2010 style upset? That's the question on every political junkie's mind in the country, I guess. Could we see a repeat of that?
Well, I think it's I saw the poll that you're referring to. It does show a surprisingly tight race. I think it was 44-40.
Right.
Ed Markey is not Martha Coakley. There's a couple of ingredients for that recipe. I think one of them is having a sort of disorganized, listless candidate on the other side. I don't think you'll get that out of Ed Markey. He's got a long, accomplished career in politics. He knows what he's doing. However, he's been running in a very safe congressional seat virtually his whole life. So this will be, or it appears to be, a competitive race. We'll get him out of his comfort zone a little bit. Gomez is actually a very interesting candidate, to say the least, for Republicans. And so I think, he has the potential to capture voters' imagination in the way that Scott Brown was able to do that. I think that component could be there for him. The other thing he would need to have is some kind of national issue that the race could be galvanized around, the way that Scott Brown's special election was largely seen as a referendum on Obamacare, because his vote was going to be, was going to matter. Probably too early, but the one thing gives me pause is knowing that I don't expect Ed Markey to be Martha Coakley. But if Gomez can get two of the other three right, it looks like we've got a chance for at least an interesting race.
All right. Well, that is an excellent analysis of that race. Thank you for that. And back to you, David.
Well, Brock, thanks again for joining us and giving us all this insight. Before you leave, I want to ask you, do you have any polls coming out soon that we should take a look for?
We were polling over the weekend. Probably too early to announce whether we may be releasing results of a survey. We tell you the situation changed in Alaska, for example, where on Friday evening, Scott Parnell, who is the governor, officially declared that he would not be running against Mark Begich for that Senate seat. And so, that leaves Joe Miller, who ran before and lost. People talk about whether Sarah Palin would be interested in that race, and there's another gentleman, Mead Treadwell. So Alaska's starting to take shape there, so we may be going in to take a look at that before too long.
Okay, well, that was good insight. We'll look for something maybe some point in the week that you've been working on over the weekend.
Sounds good. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming.
Brock.
Thank you, sir.
All righty, anytime.
Yeah.
Take care.
No problem. That was Brock McCleary of Harper Polling. It's an online, you actually rotodial poll, if you will, is I guess the best way to describe it. It's automated. Then you select your answers, and I guess there weren't as many of those firms, and Brock saw a need to have a Republican one, and I'm glad that Brock comes on and shares his insight. We got time for probably one more quick topic, and Tim, it's something you sent me just the last day or two. National Journal, the Hotline report, said that Scott Holcomb, a state representative, which I think all of us agree has a pretty bright future in politics at some level, is considering both the U.S. Senate and the governor's race. Tim, since you sent it, what's your first thought on this?
Well, I'm going to be as honest as I can, and I know that Scott is from down Catherine's way, and she'll want to chime in on this as well, but he's 40 years old. That's pretty young in political years. I wish he would do neither of them next year. First of all, if he runs for governor, he's going to lose. I know that people are saying, oh, you're being fatalistic. Well, no, I'm being realistic. If he runs for governor next year, the numbers are not there, and he's going to lose, and he may lose by a healthy margin. If he insists on running for something, well, he should run for the Senate, but I really wish he wouldn't do that either. He could come fairly close in the Senate race and perhaps propel himself to statewide prominence for the future, but I still think he'd lose the race. I don't think the time is right next year. 2018 looks a lot better, and if he does run, then I think it puts his House seat in real jeopardy. I'd be almost prepared to say that that seat might be lost. So I wish that he, and this applies to all the heavyweights in the division on our side, wish he'd wait one more year. It would be much better to see Michelle Nunn in that Senate race. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, I'm shocked. I must have missed that article because I know Scott Holcomb pretty well, and I did see him last week. I didn't talk to him specifically about his ambitions, but I would be surprised if he chose to run in 2014 after all the work they put in to get him elected into that slot and how successful he's been. But, I'm not his best friend, so I don't know. I think he would be a great senator, but I think it's a little, like you said, I think it's a little early. I think he's a little young, and I think he's a little, I don't think he's a little young. I think 40 is fine to run for Senate. I don't have a problem with that. But I do think that he's doing a lot of good work here in Georgia, and I'd like to see him continue. He was great at that press club event with where they were discussing the Democratic Party. I thought he was really on point, probably more than anyone else on that panel. I don't know if you guys saw that or read about it. I absolutely agree. I think here's my latest, just when I'm talking to my friends about this, I think our best chances are for Michelle Nunn to run for Senate and John Barrow to run for governor.
Yeah, now in that article, I think everybody gets the idea that Michelle Nunn would be a strong candidate and we risk nothing, which is important given our history in, say, 2006, where we risked two seats that we could have probably held one very easily in either Secretary of State or Lieutenant Governor. We risked the Labor Commissioner and the Attorney General. We probably could have held those. But then it mentioned that Steve Israel, a congressman in New York, it's the head of the DCCC, he's expecting John Barrow to continue to run for that seat because apparently some people are saying we need to hold that seat. I guess they think our chances are better than, you know, others may think. I mean, it may be a lot like we were talking with about the Louisiana Senate seat. I get the idea that Mary Landrieu will win because she's Mary Landrieu. John Barrow can win his seat because he's John Barrow. Somebody else in either one of those races couldn't get it done.
Right.
And David,
it'd be a 2-for-1 loss if Barrow runs for governor. I'm going to say the same thing about him. He's going to lose.
Right.
If he runs for the Senate, he's going to lose that too. Plus the seat over there that you talked about. You know, there's a difference between patience and waiting. People don't want to wait, but I need to caution, patience is a different thing. Patience is knowing when to make the move. Next year, to me, is not the right time to make the move. The demographic shifts are not in place yet. They could be by 2018, especially when the governor's race will be open then. I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Now we've gone way over.
Hopefully by 2018 we'll have some kind of progressive infrastructure in place and we'll be taking advantage of the rising American electorate, the Latinos, the Hispanics, the Asians, the young people, the unmarried women,
all the
rising American electorate. But we clearly, while there's work being done on that by various groups, I don't think we're going to be really ready for statewide and, you know, these more expensive races in 2014.
Yeah. We're way over, but I do want to kind of the last word on this. Somebody's got to run for that Senate seat, though, because to me there's a good chance that some crazy, crazy Republican candidate comes out of there, and you have to have somebody in that race. I mean, like if Joe Donnelly wouldn't have run in Indiana, then there's no way we win that race.
Somebody's
Trevor
gonna run.
Says, "Hey, I'm gonna lose." So somebody has to run for these seats. So I hope somebody of consequence steps forward. But I do agree with y'all. I think Michelle Nunn would be a great candidate that still risks nothing. Until next week, when our
David, can I jump in real quick? I know we're on overtime, but I just wanted to give props to Stacey Abrams and Eric Gray. You guys rocked the house last night up here in Chattooga County. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, I wanted to ask, she was good. What did she talk about? Did she talk about taxes?
She did, and she gave that great Democratic stump speech where the audience interacted with her and repeated what she said. It was great.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
And
she's great.
And I tell you what, I'm going to do a segue. She talked about going to a master's school in Austin, Texas. And next week we'll have double Catherines on the show, and no Tim. Tim will be off on a vacation, but Catherine from Burn Arms Report will be our special guest. And so we'll have two Catherines on the Cubs Divine next week.
Okay.
Good night, guys.
Great. Have a good vacation, Tim.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
With a strong and united America.